Welcome to the show that gets Christians thinking about faith and politics. Get ready to challenge the status quo, expand your imagination, and tackle controversy head on. Let's stand together at the intersection of faith and freedom. It's time for the Libertarian Christian Podcast.
Welcome to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast, a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute and a part of the Christians for Liberty Network. I think that's the right intro. Did I do that right, Alex?
You nailed it.
I'm Cody Cook, guest hosting today, and I'm privileged to have with me the Protestant libertarian himself, Alex Bernardo. Alex, how the heck are you?
Hey, it's good to be here, man. Without Doug, who knows what things we're going to say?
Yeah, he took a real chance just letting us go on this one. But
yeah, this is going to be the one where all the donors stop supporting the Institute.
Yeah, awesome. All right, so I had some jokes to follow that one, but I don't want to offend any of the donors. Okay, so today we're sharing our summer reading lists, but not our beach reads, because we both live near Cincinnati, Ohio, and all we've got here are some nasty lakes in the Ohio River. So, Alex, what have you been reading lately? You're pretty, what's the word I'm looking for? What's that word when you read a lot?
What is that word when you read a lot? I have no idea.
You're a very well-read individual. So what have you been reading lately?
Well, thank you. I guess the one that I wanted to start with tonight was a really interesting book that I actually picked up used about a year ago. It's called Fed Up by a woman named Danielle DiMartino Booth. And essentially, she started her career on Wall Street as some sort of financial advisor or an asset manager or something like that. But she tried to do it honestly. So she really did try to get the most amount of money out of her clients' investments as she could. And over time, I think she had a kid and she decided she didn't want to do it anymore. So she and her husband wound up moving to Dallas. And so she got a job at the Dallas Fed being kind of like a data analyst. And so she was working at the Fed throughout the 2008 financial crash and actually kind of predicted it from within her position at the Dallas Fed. And she just chronicles her story of what it was like to be there during that time. And essentially what she said was that it was her and a handful of other people in the Federal Reserve that were able to predict that this crash was coming because they were looking at data points that the PhD Fed analysts weren't. And essentially the conclusion that she came to is from before the great collapse of the economic collapse of 2008 and all through the period of quantitative easing and through zero interest rates, that all these Fed economists who were basically Keynesians, they had their models and they only really respected PhD level analysts. So they didn't give her and other like lower level analysts much credibility, but they were slavishly devoted to their models. And so they just continued to make mistake after mistake after mistake, even though the economy didn't improve. And the Federal Reserve has always been an institution that's been very conservative in the sense that they strive for agreement among all of the Fed chairs. So there was this insane amount of institutional pressure for all of the regional Fed presidents to just vote yes for whatever the Federal Reserve chairs wanted to do with the economy, which was always print more money and keep interest rates as low as possible. And this is essentially a story about how her and a handful of people within the Fed pushed back against that. Of course, we know that it didn't like wind up working out, but it was a really wild story about someone being inside of the Fed and just about the incentives of the institution and the kind of institutional arrogance that's bred by having all of these people with PhDs and essentially an unlimited amount of power making decisions that impact the rest of us when those decisions aren't based on like market data that's relevant to the average American. So it's a wild book, very good book.
So would that be easy for someone who's sort of a layman to understand? Because I'm somebody who I like the idea of economics and like in the big picture, I get it. But when it comes down to the charts and graphs, I tend to get lost.
I think it'd take a little bit of pre-reading beforehand. I would always recommend for anyone that's interested in this, Murray Rothbard's got that great book, The Case Against the Fed, which does a really good job of just explaining how the Federal Reserve operates from a big picture perspective. And then, of course, Ron Paul has his book, In the Fed. Mm-hmm. Those are two good baseline books. So if you read those two, I'm pretty sure you could hang with what she is saying in the book. I mean, a little bit of when she got into some of the really technical stuff, I was struggling. I had my Investopedia open on my phone and I was looking up some of the terms that she was using in the book to make sure I understood what she was saying. But I think the average person could stick with it. And it's interesting because she's not a libertarian, I don't think, but she's very critical of the Federal Reserve and just shows how they have such a powerful impact on our economy.
Well, so I'll play off that one and I'll mention one that I've picked up recently. It's actually a book I originally read probably in like the ninth grade. I think I just found it at either my school library or public library or something and looked interesting. So I grabbed it and I'm rereading it now and it's super cheap on Kindle. If anybody's interested, it's a sci-fi book by F. Paul Wilson called An Enemy of the State. And what's funny is when I read it, I was, generally sort of anti-establishment or whatever, a sort of a contrarian, but I wasn't really super philosophically tight in my views. So what's been interesting going back and looking at this is I didn't realize like that this book that I'd read in like ninth grade and had such an influence on me then was an ANCAP book. So the guy who wrote it, he like name checks Rothbard and Mises in the preface. And it's like, it's about a libertarian revolutionary who starts a bloodless revolution by devaluing the state's currency. And one of the things that stuck with me at the time was the sort of the calling card that his group uses is the ohm, which is like an electrical symbol for resistance. It also looks exactly like the Omega. And so when I was 18, I got this ohm tattoo based on that book. Also at the time, everybody, you know, all the kind of anti-Iraq war people were talking about, you know, whispers of a draft and stuff. And I were reading that you couldn't be in the military if you had tattoos on your neck or your hands, like if it could be visible. So that was like a little sort of 18-year-old's act of insurrection, I suppose. So anyway, I've been reading that again. And so far it still holds up. It's so funny that I was influenced by ANCAP ideas at the time and didn't really remember it or realize it. But yeah, I think it's like $3 on Kindle right now if anybody wants to grab it.
Yeah, I mean, what's the basic overall plot? So he devalues the currency and that's just, and everything kind of flows from that?
Yeah, so it's sci-fi. So you've got all these different sort of planets and there's like certain planets that are sort of independent. They're sort of like ANCAP planets, basically. And so the concern is like the main imperial planet that's, they are already sort of devaluing the currency. And the concern is that before long, they're going to start sort of molesting the ANCAP planets to try to like, because they have like all these like stockpiles of gold and precious metals. And so he's like one of the leaders, sort of leaders, like an influential person in the ANCAP, one of the ANCAP planets. And so he starts this thing where he basically is going to sort of precipitously destroy their currency and just sort of basically work on a much like more quick crash. And so what they do is they're able to get a hold of like the paper that they print the money on, and they just like print buttloads of money, and then they just start like dropping it from like spaceships onto the planets that are like already getting taxed to hell and everything. Yeah, so far it's good. I'm maybe about a third of the way into it this time around, but I'm definitely going to keep reading it. I'm enjoying it so far.
Yeah, it sounds great.
All right, so what else you got?
So the next book that I read is called Paul and Imperial Divine Honors by Clint Burnett. And I think that by the time this episode comes out, my interview with the author should already be out. It's going to be a really challenging book for a lot of libertarians who believe that early Christianity's greatest opponent was the Roman imperial cult. And the reason for that is Clint Burnett is a historian who looks specifically at archaeological evidence. So he's looking at coins, he's looking at inscriptions, things of that nature. And he's trying to bring in as much information about the imperial cult and about the way in which people within the Roman Empire honored the Caesars. And he is going to make the very provocative, but I think accurate case that there is no such thing as a monolithic imperial cult. So the way that a lot of New Testament scholars have conceptualized divine honors to the Caesars is that beginning with Augustus, there was this imperial cult that swept throughout the Roman Empire, and everyone had to give worship to the Roman emperors as if they were gods. And so that has been for New Testament scholars like N.T. Wright and Bruce Winter and some, and I mean, a lot of major New Testament scholars, that has been their model for understanding the political situation of the early church. But he's going to argue that the data is actually a lot different than that. And so he comes up with what he calls the contextual approach. And essentially what he says is that there is no such thing as a monolithic imperial cult. Yes, people did offer divine honors to Caesars, but the ways in which people offered those divine honors were contextual. It depends on what kind of city you're in. So in a Greek city like Thessalonica, they are going to have a different way of honoring the emperor than in a Roman city like Corinth or like Philippi. And when he looks at a lot of this evidence, one of the arguments that people like N.T. Wright make are that terms like Lord and Savior and Gospel are all a part of Roman imperial ideology, and they're all a part of the language of the imperial cult. And he's going to argue that there's just like absolutely no evidence for that whatsoever. And that while there were times in the life of the early church that the beliefs and the practice of the early Christians conflicted with Roman imperial ideology, the actual arguments that a lot of New Testament scholars have made to justify that have been overplayed. And he gives all the historical evidence for that. It's a very convincing argument that I think nuances the anti-imperial reading of Paul. It's not that the early Christians wouldn't have been uncomfortable with certain aspects of the Roman imperial cult. It just wasn't at the center of the thought of many early Christians. He's going to argue in a chapter on Corinthians that for the Corinthians, that wasn't an issue that they were dealing with at all. Like their Roman imperial cult was the least of their concerns. And when Paul writes that letter, he's not dealing dealing with that issue at all. So it is really, really important. I think that for a lot of libertarians to have, I don't want to say superficial because that's not the right word, but for a lot of libertarians that have a very simplistic reading of Roman imperial ideology in the first century, this book offers a lot of excellent context and nuance for that debate. And I've becoming increasingly critical of the anti-imperial reading of Paul in general, just because I think that it does not take into consideration every aspect of Paul's thoughts. I really do think that the Roman Empire is certainly a part of Paul's thinking. And I definitely believe that Paul would teach that the Roman Empire is kind of consigned to the old creation and would eventually be done away with, and that there might be times that Christians have to actively resist it. But I just don't think that it's as central to Paul's thought as it is to 21st century Christians who have certain political agendas that are underwritten by the anti-imperial reading. So really good book. I would highly recommend it to everyone. It is a little bit technical in place, but the great thing about it is it's got lots of pictures. So even Doug can understand what he's writing in the book.
That's good. That's great. Yeah. So it seems to me, as I'm listening to this, and I haven't read the book, but if you could make an argument that the Roman imperial cult is not as prevalent in the ancient Roman context as we imagine it is, then that would seem to make the anti-imperial statements that are in the New Testament stronger, right? So that, you know, if we can sort of demonstrate what they're critiquing is not as bad as we initially thought, but they're still saying things like Satan is behind this and powers and principalities, you know, sort of form that sort of matrix, that there are these sort of spiritual demonic powers that are intertwined with political power. If they would say that, even though it turns out that we've maybe overread the significance of the Roman imperial cult, so that sort of, I don't know, maybe a less idolatrous institution than we imagined or something like that, I think that only really makes what their concerns are stronger in a way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. And that's where you have to have books like Revelation that come into play, because Revelation is explicitly anti-imperial and there's no way around that. I think that, and we talk about this a little bit in our interview, I really do believe that in the 21st century, there are so many Christians that want their political positions to be justified by the biblical text. And the anti-imperial reading of Paul is vague enough that you can be a progressive or a conservative or a libertarian and say, oh, Paul's anti-imperial. Well, what is the empire that we're against? Well, it's whatever the other people believe that I don't like. Whereas I think for Paul, he didn't obsess about politics and the political process in the same way that we did. And the idea that there were Christians that were being forced by sword point to offer sacrifices to living Caesars, there's just no historical evidence for that being a widespread practice, at least during the time the New Testament was being written. So I think that has to temper the way in which we under, because again, if we're going to be biblically based Christians, we should actually want to represent what Paul was trying to communicate to his audience. And so I don't think we should overstate a case that Paul doesn't actually make in the New Testament, if that makes sense.
I think it makes a lot of sense. It seems to me that the weakness of the anti-imperial reading of Paul, I guess there's two of them. One is that they read it in where it doesn't really fit, or it's not really obvious, and thus they sort of weaken their overall case. And I think the other problem is it largely comes from a sort of progressive kind of post-colonial perspective, which is not totally invalid, but I think it's reading more kind of modern progressive concerns into the text than are probably there, right?
Yeah, I completely agree. And I was talking to Preston Sprinkle about this when I had him on my show a couple of months ago. And we were talking about the work of Najib Haddad, who's a New Testament scholar. He's got two books that are very critical of the anti-imperial reading of Paul. And I read both of them and they're really good. And he makes a lot of excellent points. We've been trying to get an interview and I think we got one scheduled for early June. So hopefully that'll come out around the time that this is out too. But essentially what the comment that Preston Sprinkle made when I asked him about Haddad's work is that every time there's an election, there's a whole new wave of Paul and Empire books that are published. And that tends to be the way that Paul and imperial scholarship works. It's that, all right, we're going to take an angle that just so happens to neatly correspond to some sort of modern political ideology. And we're going to read that back into Paul. And I just don't think as Christians, we can do that. And it's not about, and as libertarians, we have to be very careful not to read our modern libertarian ideology back into the Bible, because the reality is Paul and Jesus, they couldn't have been libertarians because that wasn't even a category that was available in the ancient world. And we just need to be careful to make sure that we don't misrepresent what they say by trying to force them into our modern mold.
Good. I agree. So I'll mention another one that I'm part of the way through. It's a nonfiction, I guess not graphic novel, graphic nonfiction, written by Brian Kaplan, the economist at, I shouldn't have said at, because I knew right as I was saying it that I was like, I couldn't remember where he was teaching. And then I was like, well, I'm going to remember it after I say at. Anyway, George Mason, I think, University. So anyway, he's an economist who's, this is a second graphic novel that he's written, or graphic nonfiction. So the first one was called Open Borders, and he sort of makes a I think, a pretty compelling case. He's a libertarian anarchist himself. He made a pretty compelling case for sort of a strong open immigration platform in that book. And this book is called, his new book is called Build Baby Build. And it's basically about how regulation increases housing costs and makes it more difficult for all of us to live according to our means. So far, I'm about halfway through that one, and I really like it. I need to just make a little bit more time to sit down and finish reading it. It's really enjoyable. The sort of graphic approach to it makes it very easy to digest. Also, I think probably very easy to share with others who maybe you couldn't hand them a book on sort of straight economics, but you could hand them something like that. And it's a lot more persuasive, a lot more attractive, and a lot more digestible. So that's what I've also been reading.
So does he do the whole thing where he looks at kind of Federal Reserve policy and then those other federal policies that are supposed to stimulate like home buying? What are some of his angles that he takes in there?
So far, what he's kind of looking at is the ways in which that the federal and state and sometimes even local regulation, zoning, things like that, make it much more difficult to build. And so there is sort of this de-incentivization to build. And so then we look at the housing crisis, we say we don't have enough housing, it costs too much. And he's like, well, that's because we're de-incentivized from building, essentially. He also recently just published an article on Reason where he sort of an addendum to the book where he's like, I really should have included this in the book, but I didn't. But it's a sort of a second argument that he makes that one thing that would also be really beneficial is if the government would privatize some of the federal and state-owned land. And I don't know. I kind of like the idea of having sort of locally managed parks and sites and things like that. I don't necessarily know if McDonald's needs to own the Grand Canyon. But overall, I think he makes some pretty strong arguments, especially when you look at some of these states that are like 50% federal lands. And it's like, that's just insane. Like, what, why? And, you know, when we're supposed to be having this housing crisis, nobody can afford to buy a home, and we're blaming it on greedy capitalists. And it's like, well, the greedy capitalists want to build things and sell them to you. Like, just let them do it. And then we'll have this surplus of housing and the cost will go down, right? But we can't do that because there's basically too much government regulation in the way.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I read a book, I guess it was about a year ago. It was edited by Friedrich Hayek, and he wrote an essay in it. This is a collection of essays called Capitalism and the Historian. Are you familiar with that one?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, essentially, what the purpose of the collection of essays is to explore why there are so many historians that are just automatically against capitalism from the beginning. But there's a really interesting article in there where they talk about the Industrial Revolution in England. And you know, the whole Charles Dickens line that, you know, all these people moved into the city and they lived in like filth and squalor in the cities in these tiny little houses that were crammed and they burned to the ground and everything like that. And then, of course, that's always blamed on the industrialists. It's always blamed on the rise of capitalism, and that kind of compromises the beautiful agrarian society, the progressive imagination. But one of the points that they made, and I forget, I think it's T.S. Ashton is the author of this particular piece, but one of the points that he made in that piece was that if you look at like the building regulations in London at the time, the government regulated the size of houses, the government regulated like the kind of materials you could use, and also they were involved in trying to build this massive empire. And so importing higher quality wood, importing higher quality glass, all of that was incredibly expensive. So it was actually all of these government policies, a lot of them linked to British imperialism, that made the housing in London so terrible at that time. So I feel like that kind of segues perfectly with Kaplan's point. Like, anytime you let the government get involved in the housing industry, it's going to make it more expensive and lower quality.
I agree. All right, what else you got? What else have you been reading?
Yeah, the next one I want to talk about too is another political one. And I had this guy on the show too. Most of the reading that I do, unfortunately, has been for, not unfortunately, it's not a bad thing, but most of it's been for the podcast. So I don't get to, I'm sure you understand this too, that when you're in our position, you have to do a lot of reading for our shows. You don't just get to explore your own interests. But this one was really great. The guy reached out to the Libertarian Christian Institute and offered his new book. David Beto is the name of the scholar, and he's got a brand new book called The New Deal's War on the Bill of Rights. And it's a really fascinating book because it looks at the ways that the Roosevelt administration just completely trampled upon people's basic rights in pursuit of the New Deal and his progressive agenda. And he starts out the book with a really provocative opening chapter where he says that, like most progressives, FDR was not a means person, he was an ends person. So it didn't really matter what he had to do to see his ends be accomplished. He would take whatever means necessary in order to get there. And so the book is really wild to read and also very relevant because it talks about how FDR was deliberately monitoring his political oppositions through his allies in the Senate. And there were a couple of committees that were established by FDR allies that spied on people's telegrams, everyone coming in and out of Washington that were accused of having any sort of political dealings. I mean, hundreds of thousands of telegrams were monitored by government officials, a complete breach of people's First Amendment rights. It also looks at how the Roosevelt administration did everything they could to censor radio through the Federal Radio Commission. And the goal was to try to suppress anyone that dissented from the New Deal line. And then when we get into World War II, anyone that was anti-war, that was concerned about America's involvement in this European war. And it also looks at how many of his allies in major cities like Memphis were actively persecuting Black people and other minority people in those cities, and how FDR just allowed it to happen. Because again, at that time, like in the South, the majority of Blacks were Republicans. And so they were obviously very much opposed to FDR's New Deal, and he wanted to suppress them. And so it's a really frustrating book to read. And Beto says at the very beginning, you know, everyone knows about his internment camps and about how terrible FDR treated the Japanese, but that was the peak of the mountain. That wasn't even the entire climb. It's a very frustrating book to read, but it also goes to show you that a lot of the tools that our government uses today to censor information and try to control and manipulate the data that the average Americans are exposed to have roots that go back almost 100 years. So it's a fantastic book. The interview I did with him is crazy. The book is really, really a great read, and it will leave you frustrated. It will leave you feeling like the time that we're in right now did not just begin 4 or 5 years ago, but it's an incredibly informative book. So I would highly recommend that one to everyone.
Yeah, not to mention his attempted TikTok ban, right?
Say what?
No, I'm just kidding. FDR's.
Oh, FDR's. Yeah. Oh, FDR's. Okay. I thought you were talking about Beto getting kicked off of TikTok. Yeah. I was like, what? That's crazy. But I mean, it wouldn't surprise me since the government's trying to ban TikTok right now.
Yeah, yeah. So it sounds like if you didn't roll with FDR, you're really in trouble back then. Okay, so let's see here. I've got one that's not relevant at all to the LCI stuff, but it's one I've been enjoying. I've been reading Sly Stone's memoir. Thank you for letting me be myself again. The Sly from Sly and the Family Stone, the funk band. I'm a big fan of funk music, so I've enjoyed this one. Planning on maybe getting George Clinton's after this one. His memoir, Brothers Be Yo Like George, Ain't That Funkin' Kinda Hard on You? It's actually the title.
Nice.
And so I've been going back a little bit and sort of filling in some of the knowledge I don't have, because I enjoy a lot of the music, but I don't necessarily know a lot of how some of these folks came to be where they are and that sort of thing. So that is my not libertarian, not Christian, just sort of just an enjoyer of funk music side of me.
Is it like a VH1 Behind the Music type documentary? Not documentary, but type novel or whatever you call it.
He's kind of talking about how he got started. And so it's like a memoir, kind of biography type thing. It was actually put out by Questlove's From the Roots, his imprint, his publishing imprint, which this is not going to be relevant for people who aren't very familiar with funk music. But Questlove's imprint is, it's like when you see it written out, how does he spell it? It's like AOWA or something. And you don't really know how to pronounce it. But the Questlove thing is actually an audiobook that I'm listening to. So he actually pronounces the imprint, and it's Allah, like Prince does when he, you know. So that, nice. So there's that sort of a deep cut of the funk music there that he named his imprint after a sound that Prince often made in his music. So yeah, none of that's relevant to the LCI crowd unless you guys also are lovers of funk music, but that is something I've been reading, so I included it on the list.
I had no idea that you like funk music. Have you always been into funk music, or is this a new hobby?
Yeah, pretty much, at least junior high, high school. I probably always enjoyed it a little bit, but I think I probably got really heavy into it through Prince, and then you sort of span out from there because he sort of was involved with George Clinton a little bit. And once you start listening to his live bootlegs, you hear other bands he's covered, and he started to make sort of connections. But I got a real sort of a appreciation for it. So yeah, I'll probably start reading more memoirs as I go forward. Actually, in Dayton, there was a funk museum, and they still have their website, but I'm a little bit confused if they're actually open right now, but I haven't had a chance to visit if they are, but I'd like to, if they are open or if they become open again soon.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Those musicians are incredibly talented, though. That's what a lot of people don't realize. Like, it's all upbeat and everything like that, but to be able to play tightly as a funk band, you look at someone, I mean, all of those guys are phenomenal, and it's incredibly fun to watch, and it's a lot of fun to listen to as well. I have a ton of respect for that genre of music.
I had a friend who, he had like an uncle, someone who had been involved in James Brown's band at one point, and he had said that there's a thing that James Brown would do sometimes when he was, you know, was performing. And what he was doing is he was signaling that someone in the band had made a mistake, that they should be docked. And so he kept like a really tight band, and he would do the same thing. And I think he would do this thing that Prince also sort of copied, where he could stop the band and start right back up. But anyway, sort of a, his band had to be incredibly tight, incredibly talented to follow what he wanted them to do.
Yeah, that's cool. That's cool.
All right. So I'm assuming that you probably don't have a funk musicians book on your list. So what's your next one?
The last one I wanted to talk about is one I just got in the mail last week. It's not coming out until June, but James McGrath is a New Testament scholar from, I believe, it's Butler University in Indiana. I had him back on my show. He has a great book called The A to Z of the New Testament, which is all about what New Testament scholars want the average Bible reader to know about the Bible. That was an awesome one, but he's got a brand new book coming out in June called Christmaker, which is a biography of John the Baptist. So a really interesting historical figure, and there's not been a lot of biographies on them because historians have tended to, and as he explains in the book, historians have tended to assume that we just don't have a lot of historical information on him. So what James McGrath does is he goes back and looks at some of the historical data that has often been forgotten by New Testament scholars and tries to paint a more compelling and a more thorough portrait of John the Baptist than those that have come before him. Really interesting. He points out, and this is something that I didn't know earlier in the book, that of course his father was a priest and the priestship was hereditary in Jewish culture. So John would have been expected to have been a priest, but his mother offers him up in a Nazarite vow to God, which means that he could not have been a priest because he was set aside for that other vow. So John was kind of caught in between these two roles and he couldn't play both of them. And so McGrath is going to say that that might have been one of the situations that John the Baptist was in that kind of triggered him to reassess the temple system. And it's very clear that when he went out into the wilderness and began baptizing people, that he was deliberately not only critiquing the Jewish temple, but offering an alternative to it. And that meant that everyone could come to John and undergo the immersion and find the same forgiveness that they would find in the temple. He also talks in the book, and this is a chapter I read last night, about how we get this picture, if we read the Bible casually, that John was out in the middle of the desert somewhere, miles and miles away from where people were. But McGrath makes the point that in the time of Jesus, the wilderness that John the Baptist was in, there was actually a Roman highway that ran right through it. And it was kind of out in the sticks, but it was in between some major cities. And so it was a little bit out there, but it was easily accessible. And so John was able to draw large crowds from these cities to come and hear him preach. And so I know that in the next couple of chapters, he's going to set up how Jesus was influenced by John the Baptist. So it's a really interesting book, and it's one that I'm excited to finish. And I will definitely have him on my show to talk about him.
Yeah, I'd be interested in hearing. So I know John Bergsma, who's a scholar who's focused on that kind of intertestamental period, has made the argument that John the Baptist may have been a former Essene. Yeah. Do you know if he treats that argument in the book?
Yeah, he does. He has a pretty long section on that. And he says that it definitely appears as if he had connections with the Essenes at some point. But there are several ways in which John's teachings converge very neatly with the teachings of the Essenes. And then there are other ways that John's teachings diverge from them. So he does kind of play out the possibility that John was influenced by that group.
Yeah, he obviously doesn't seem to be part of the Qumran community at the time that he's out in the wilderness baptizing people. But, but there are certainly some connections.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so I'll mention this kind of a quick series of books. So other reading that I've been doing has been in conjunction with a couple things I'm prepping for. So I'm prepping for a debate with Jacob Winograd on Christian pacifism that should be
LCI debate.
Yeah, LCI debate coming out beginning of June. It's not really publicly promoted yet. And actually, maybe by this point, I don't know when this recording is going to be out. It may have already happened. So by talking about it, I might just be just rubbing salt in my own wounds now. But yeah, so doing a debate on Christian pacifism where I'm taking the pro case. I'm also finalizing kind of like an online class. I'm trying to put together just like an independent thing on the Sermon on the Mount. So I've been reading some books on nonviolence, but new ones as well as books from my library. So one I picked up is by Helen Painter, P-A-Y-N-T-E-R, called Blessed Are the Peacemakers. And I actually started this one before we started playing the debate, but I think it's going to be useful. It's essentially a biblical theology of human violence. She kind of takes the Old New Testament and kind of runs through there and looks at the way human violence is presented in both positive and negative connotations, and then gives some sort of practical outline for kind of where you could go from that data point or those data points. I've also been revisiting John Howard Yoder, who's a Mennonite scholar who wrote some very influential books on nonviolence, actually very powerful stuff too. Unfortunately, he was also a total skeeze toward women. So a lot of his work has been taken out of print. So it's really hard to get a hold of. So unless you happen to have it already in your library, you can get a used copy from somewhere. It's not going to be easy to get a hold of. So it's unfortunate that those great books are going to lose a lot of their reach, but I can really only blame him for that. you know, unfortunately, he made himself indispensable to the modern theology on that topic. And then he was a total douche, frankly. And so now nobody can benefit from that work that he did. So I've also been looking at a book by André Trocmé, who is a French theologian. He was also a pastor who led like a nonviolent resistance movement against the Nazis that was really effective, actually. He and this, I think another pastor in this, basically this whole town in France, led this basically non-cooperation movement against the Nazis. And the Nazis basically had to keep sending in new soldiers because they were being corrupted. They were sort of going native. So the book I'm reading of his right now is called Jesus and the Nonviolent Revolution. And his core argument is actually kind of an interesting one. It's that Jesus's ministry was largely focused on announcing that the Jubilee had come, you know, that sort of whole message that he preaches in the synagogue from Isaiah. And that's probably not super controversial because, you know, as Protestants, we like the idea of God forgiving our sins. But Trocmé also argues that basically it's also like a warning to the rich to forgive the debts of the poor and do essentially what the Jubilee did, which was to level out society again, sort of rebalance those kind of stratifications. And if they didn't, then God would do the leveling for them. So it's an interesting hypothesis with some biblical warrant, but I'm not sure how persuaded I am of it in all of its details. But, you know, sometimes it's interesting to read something even if you don't totally agree with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I will mention one more book that I've been reading, which is Caesar and the Sacrament, which is the book for this month's, well, depending on when somebody's listening to this, for May's book club, LCI book club. And we've got a great lineup of book clubs for the summer that you can check out on our event page. And his argument's pretty interesting. I'm not persuaded at all of its details, but I actually wrote an article in 2022 for LCI called, I think it was titled The American Sacrament That Denies Allegiance to Christ. But the central aspect of, I think maybe the strongest point that he's going to make is that when the word sacrament starts to be used in a religious context, it's used by Tertullian, who is contrasting Christian sacrament with the sacrament to Caesar. And he said that you sort of can't partake in both at the same time. And so then that sort of opens this conversation. Well, what does sacrament mean? Where does that word come from? And so Street develops some of that historical data, and that ends up being a really interesting case that he makes. So yes, if people are reading and are interested in hanging out with LCI folks, like I've co-led a couple of them. You've co-led, I think, one or two so far.
Yeah.
One. And Doug's generally involved also. But, you know, we got some great folks at LCI who've been involved in some of these, and you should definitely go to our events page and check out future ones that are coming. Is there anything that I'm sure you've got a big pile of books like I do that you're planning on reading at some point. So what do you think on that big pile you're actually going to read next?
Well, I know I got a stack of books from IVP and Ehrman's coming my way. So I have my summer reading list kind of cut out from me. There is one that I might try to do an episode on this, but it's not related to any of the publisher stuff I'm doing right now. It's called Rethinking the Dates of the New Testament by Jonathan Bernier, I think is how you pronounce his last name. But essentially, I picked it up about a year. It's only about a year old. And I picked it up about a year ago, started it, and then I had to stop it because of some podcast stuff. But I picked it back up again. And he makes a very compelling historical argument that the texts that are included in the New Testament were all written at a much earlier date than many New Testament scholars attribute to them. So it's a really interesting book. This, besides that, though, this summer, my goal before I started the podcast, really before COVID, you know, I'm a social studies teacher and I teach the Middle Ages. And so I have a very good library of books on medieval history. And I used to read quite a bit of it. There are a bunch of books I had that I intended to read. And because of all the COVID stuff and me diving into political philosophy and economics, and then with starting the podcast and diving back into biblical studies, I've put a lot of my study of medieval history on hold. So I'm hoping this summer that I can snag three or four of those books off the shelf and read them just for the pure enjoyment of being able to learn more about the time period that I teach so much and I'm actually interested in. But I mean, again, Cody, as you know, we all have a limited amount of time, so we can only really, you know, you have to pick and choose what you can read. But I'm hoping to get around to some more medieval history this summer. So we'll see if that actually happens. I promised myself that I'm going to get at least one, but hopefully it'll be more than that.
Yeah, I think all of us are just crossing our fingers that we can read more books about medieval history like you are.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. This is where if you're listening to this, you should donate to LCI, because if we were all very wealthy, then we wouldn't have to have day jobs and we could just read all the time. And all of our commentary is incredibly intelligent right now, but imagine how intelligent and excellent our commentary would be if we could do nothing but study and read and write. It would be incredible. We could change. We could, what's that stupid phrase that the old LP always used? to use Set the World Free in Our Lifetime. We could do that if you guys donate to LCI. So give us all your money and we're going to make everything better.
There's the libertarian capitalist pitch right there.
There it is.
Yeah. So a couple things that are on my list next. You mentioned, I think you mentioned Rothbard, maybe in this conversation. I have yet to read What Has Government Done to Our Money, but sort of relevant to what you talked about with the Fed, something I plan on reading. I have read Ron Paul's and the Fed and thought that was fine, but looking forward to maybe reading Rothbard's take on it.
Yeah. Do you have a copy of that?
I think I've got it on Audible, so I can listen to it.
Okay, cool. Because he's got the copy I have from the Mises Institute. It's got that. And then at the end of it, there's another 25-page essay called The Case for the 100% Gold Standard or something like that. Both of them are really good. And since we live close, you ever wanted to borrow the hard copy, I would be more than happy to let you borrow it.
Yeah, awesome. So you're also on my list. I plan on reading The Identity Trap by Yasha Monk, it's a critique of identity politics. And I've heard some interviews and things from articles he's written in the past. So I think that could be a good book. Other than that, I'm actually going to be prepping for an introduction to the Pentateuch for my church's Bible study soon. So if anybody has any recommendations for a Pentateuch theologies or commentaries that you think are just really exceptional, feel free to shoot me a message because I'm looking for recommendations right now on those. That's basically all I got for now. Do you got anything you want to end up on, Alex?
Cody, I think you did a great job co-hosting Doug's show. We promised that we were going to make a bunch of inappropriate comments and say a lot of cuss words. So should we throw some in right now, or what do you think we should do with that?
So what we're going to do for that is if you're a regular listener and you're not like part of the, you know, like the LCI subscribers, then you're not going to get to hear that. But if you're an LCI subscriber, if you're part, you know, of that sort of premium content, you can stay on and you'll get to hear just the most horrible, inappropriate, filthy, disgusting jokes you've ever heard.
Yeah, absolutely. Behind the paywall.
Yeah. But we should probably end here. So we're going to end right now, and then we're going to go into our version of the aristocrats joke. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And I wrote down how to introduce an LCI podcast, but I didn't write down how to close one.
We all do it differently. I don't know. This is always so awkward. Here's what we should do. I think we should just hit the stop button and then no outro music this time. Wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah, let's just do it.
All right. All right, right on.